Blog Talk Radio.
During the last couple of months have been highly unusual. The following is from a recent article in the Los Angeles Times. It's not that the Midwest hasn't been extremely hot before. And it's not that it hasn't been incredibly dry, but it's unusual for a vast swath of the Midwest to be so very hot and so very dry for so very long, particularly this early in the summer. The current heat wave, which is spurring comparisons to the Carostratus heat of 1936, is out of whack, meteorologist Jim Keeney said Friday in an interview with the Los Angeles Times. Corn crops typically pollinate and mature in June and early July. That's why this time of the year is so vitally important for corn. We have reached a make-it-or-break-it moment. The following is how AccuWeather.com report describes what is happening right now. Either heat or drought can stress the stalks, but both can basically shut down the pollination process. When this happens, few, small, or no ears of corn form. According to AccuWeather.com, agricultural meteorologists, you can't raise a corn crop with less than an inch of rain over 6 weeks, combined with 100-degree and higher temperatures. However, these conditions have taken place in much of the southern corn belt through the week of July 4, 2012. If pollination does not happen, corn farmers might as well give up. Just check out what agricultural economist Chris Hertz said the other day. Pollination problems just can't be overcome, even if the weather turns. There's no turning back. There's just failure. At this point, half of all the corn in the state of Indiana is already in poor shape. With each passing day, the condition of the corn gets even worse. As a recent article in the Chicago Tribune detailed, many farmers feel completely helpless at the moment. David Kestel, who farms about 1,300 acres in Manhattan, about 40 miles south of Chicago, said he feels helpless. Every day you get out there, it's the same heat and cloudless sky, he said. You see your corn just withering out there, knowing you can't do anything about it. Oh, these poor people. The United States is suffering from a severe lack of rain. Just look at the chart posted below. According to the U.S. Drought Monitor, most of the country is experiencing drought conditions right now. You can't see this map, but it shows that most of the country is not getting the rain they should have. These drought conditions have also played a major role in a huge number of wildfires that we have seen lately. There are a few northern states that are not feeling the drought right now, but otherwise the rest of the country is extremely dry. So what does all of this mean for you and I? A recent article by Holly Deo summarized why we should all be praying for rain. Since 75% of grocery store products use corn as a key ingredient, expect food prices to skyrocket. Corn is also a staple in many fast foods. Corn is an ethanol in the main food source of chickens. In addition to this, maize is in many things that aren't obvious, like adhesives, aluminum, aspirin, clothing, starch, cosmetics, cough syrup, dry cell batteries, envelopes, fiberglass insulation, gelatin capsules, ink, insecticides, paint, penicillin, powders, rugs, carpet stands, talcum, toothpaste, wallpaper, and vitamins. That's just for starters. This is a huge heads-up for you to purchase corn-using products now before these conditions reflect in grocery stores. It will be a narrow window of opportunity. Oh, thank you, Leo. It just fixed my computer.
Okay. These thoughts are being echoed by all the agricultural economists as well, and according to Business Week, the outlook on U.S. food prices is bleak. When people look at the rising price of hamburger, butter, eggs, and other protein sources from higher corn costs, that's when more money ends up in the food basket, said Michael Swanson, Minneapolis agriculture guy. We were hoping for a break, and we aren't going to get it. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the fact that the corn is dying all over America is not just a problem for the United States. As Business Week also recently noted, the fate of U.S. corn affects the entire globe. When rain doesn't fall in Iowa, it's not just Des Moines that starts spreading. Food buyers from Addis Ababa to Beijing are touched by the fate of the corn crop in the U.S. The world's breadbasket is in an era when crop shortages mean riots. This year, they have reason to be concerned. Stockpiles of corn in the U.S. tumbled 48% between March and June, and the biggest drop since 1996. The U.S. Department of Agriculture said last week, and that was before drought hit the Midwest. And the United States is the world's biggest exporter of corn by far. And if there is a massive corn crop failure in America, it's going to be felt to the four corners of the earth. And just check out the Abu Azriza Bazan, a senior economist with the UN Food Organization, said the other day, everyone watches the U.S. because they can rely on it. Without it, the world would starve. And back in February, I wrote an article that suggested that we could see Dust Bowl conditions return to the middle part of the country in the years ahead. A lot of people were skeptical of that article, and not quite as many people are skeptical today. The following... Hang on a second here.
This is from a recent article posted on MSNBC entitled, Fears of a New Dust Bowl as Heat and Drought Shrivel Corn in the Midwest. Crop insurance agents and agricultural economists are watching closely, a few comparing the situation with the devastating drought of 1988, when corn yield shriveled significantly, while some farmers have been alluding unhappily to the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. For more is at stake in the coming pivotal days, with the brief, delicate phase of pollination imminent in many states, miles and miles of corn will rise or fall and whether rain soon appears and temperatures moderate. As I wrote about last week, if the weather doesn't turn around soon, the implications are going to be staggering. Even if we got some significant rainfall at this point, a tremendous amount of damage has already been done, according to the Washington Post.
Jay Armstrong, owner and operator of Armstrong Farms in Kansas, flew a small plane over a portion of the affected area and landed with the impression that the potential damage is far worse than is commonly understood. At this time of year, when you look down in a place like Indiana or Illinois, you should see just lush green fields, Armstrong said. I saw bare soil. I just thought to myself, the market has no idea what's coming. So is there significant rain in the forecast? And unfortunately, the answer is no. National Weather Service says that the Corn Belt will experience above normal temperatures and below normal rainfall over the next week. But as at this point, it does not look like there will be any significant rainfall for the foreseeable future. And needless to say, that's really bad news. But right now, we just have more heat and more dryness to look forward to. The skies are like iron and the earth is like brass. We like to think that we have conquered nature, but at moments such as these, we see that's not true at all.
A couple of weeks ago, I wrote an article about all of the reasons why we should be concerned about the second half of 2012. In this article, I did not even mention drought and crop failures. Sometimes major problems have a way of piling on top of themselves. The U.S. economy is already in bad enough shape without adding major crop failure into the mix. This is something that we just don't need right now. But it looks like we're going to have to deal with it unless there is a major change in the weather. Food prices are going to go up even more, and a large numbers of farmers and ranchers are going to be absolutely devastated. Let's all pray for rain. We desperately need it. Oh, boy.
Yeah. Amazing. It's amazing. So, anyway, I didn't mean to really hit you with bad news, but there's really not much good news. And this one... everybody knows about TEPCO and the crazy bastards that run that operation in Japan. All right, but one thing that Tokyo Electric Power Company can be relied upon for is a never-ending stream of disinformation cesium-laden piles of putridity. First, there's a matter of the Unit 4 spent fuel pool that many experts claim could collapse in a major earthquake leading to the massive release of radiation. When I sent the story written by Japanese diplomat Akio Matsumuro to a Japanese professor I know whose focus is international relations, the tenure-track professor dismissed it as tabloid journalism. Talk about a nation with its focus on its own navel. They don't even know when the danger they are in spite of the 3/11 catastrophe. That was last year. Can you imagine what respectable people would attend conferences and wear suits and ties would have to say to, of someone like me if I went to on a campaign to alert people of the disaster that awaited Japan pre-March 11th? I would have been completely ignored or laughed at as a Cassandra and a conspiracy nut. So were many sincere anti-nuclear activists at the Citizen Nuclear Information Center in Tokyo. And it's really quite frightening.
This is from Rents.com.
Yeah.
Now we have attempted to attend to the matter of TEPCO's arrogant stupidity, snideness, and snottiness. On April 26, 2012, TEPCO attempted to refute claims by Arne Gunnarsson and other nuclear experts that the Unit 4 fuel pool building was tilting. TEPCO stated that the number 4 reactor building is not tilted and it, including the storage pool, will not be destroyed by a quake. Yet very recently we learned from NHK and TEPCO itself that the Unit 4 building is less stable than previously thought. NHK, the conservative government-run news station, reports of tilted walls found at Fukushima No. 4 reactor, which is different than the entire building being tilted, but does indicate serious problems. TEPCO itself has admitted that the reactor 4 bulge is worse than previously announced. The Fukushima Diary website reports that southwest corner of reactor 4 building turned out to be bulged and leaning outward. This clearly contradicts TEPCO's earlier illogical stance quoted above and analyzed and debunked elsewhere. There is more evidence of contradictions from TEPCO, who appear to run the Japanese government based on statements made by TEPCO in a recent news report versus what the government has stated regarding the speed to which TEPCO will remove the fuel rods from the badly damaged Unit 4 building. Perhaps international pressure along with the vociferous anti-nuclear domestic protests are working to some extent, given the following report. Workers at the crippled Fukushima nuclear plant will begin removing fuel rods from a damaged reactor a year ahead of schedule, a government minister said June 21st, a move to address concerns about the risk of a new quake that could cause a further accident and scatter more radioactive debris. We would like to start taking out undamaged fuel this year. Preparation is now underway. Japan's Nuclear Crisis Commissioner, Minister Goshi Hosono, told Reuters in an interview. However, in the recent news report aired on June 25, 2012, by ABC Australia, we learned from the TEPCO spokesman that they have no plans to remove the fuel rods until 2013. Perhaps the word did not get out there, or there is a disconnect between what the government is trying to promote versus what TEPCO is deciding to do. It's another case of the Keystone Cops playing a game of tiddlywinks with Larry Curley and Mo Outfit.
The Japan government.
That's the Japanese government. It is worth noting that while the ABC Australia report did an excellent job of highlighting the dangers of the UF4 spent fuel pool issue, Australia itself is a major exporter of uranium to Japan and part of the global nuclear mafia, which benefits from the incredibly expensive and financially dangerous nuclear energy scam.
Fantastic.
Dangerous, yes. It is another matter of TEPCO's bad behavior, we learned, just as in the case of BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. When BP was actually put in charge of the disaster, the cleanup, so too has TEPCO taking over the jurisdiction of Japanese waters. Oh, my God.
Many Japanese are wary of the government's assurances about test results, and Tokyo Electric has made people more suspicious by refusing to let independent experts survey waters instead of the roughly 12-mile exclusion zone around the plant. I don't think anyone now would lie about radiation levels, but in the end, it's the consumer who decides, said Yoki Shasiato, the wholesaler who handles tuna, crab, and seafood. If nothing else, fish caught near Fukushima would probably fetch far lower prices.
So, as if they're going to tell you that.
Whether or not Fukushima seafood is safe for eating or not, this government survey of seawater near the TEPCO Fukushima No. 1 nuclear reactor power plant shows very low levels of radiation detected. Apparently, the charts convey a contradiction reading of ND, meaning not detectable, while at the same time recording levels of 1.3 becquerels of cesium or 134 per liter of seawater, meaning 11. But anyway, that's what's happening there at TEPCO. I mean, we're getting screwed again and again and again and again and again. And it's just coming, getting worse and worse and worse.
Oh, here's an audio piece.
Yeah. This is a little too long.
Oh, that's
but
too
I had,
bad.
I had this one that, I don't believe that, that's a satire. This one here. Border closed to those who refuse to reveal private data to officials. This was really interesting. Israel border invasion. Okay, your private data, please. All right, and we can check that out in a minute. But there's there was one that was much better that I wanted to get to tonight because excuse me. What did you can go to the White House? Anyway, the one that I wanted to do. Webster Tarpley, and he was talking, and it was really quite good. They discussed the reason why or what America is actually doing, together with England. All right. And the reason for this is because of the way that they do these things. Okay, is they're trying to destroy all sovereign countries because they need the resources, and the only way they can do that is by toppling these governments that are saying no,
mm-hmm.
right? So the whole thing with NATO and the United States and Britain is to go in and to destroy these countries like Syria and Libya and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to go to that because it was very, very fascinating. Of course, it was by Press TV, which is the Iranian TV, but nevertheless, Tarpley is genuinely, usually right on when it comes to these things. He's been writing about it for a long time. I'm hoping I can get to it. Hopefully.
Mm. There you go. Okay. Now we
gotta
find it.
Yeah, it's right there. I'll get it. 1 second. And and I want to read another story tonight about cell phone radiation. Really bad news. But something that people just are not, you know, they're just not being told. You know, everybody who has a cell phone is looking at terminal illness within the next 15 years. You know, brain damage.
U.S. plans destruction of all sovereign states.
Yeah, this is very, very good. Very good article. Very good video, audio. So let's listen to this. It's about 6 minutes, but it's very worthwhile by listening to it.
Okay.
He's being interviewed by Iranian television.
Well, from Washington, I'm joined by Webster Griffin Tarpley, author and historian. Welcome to the program, sir. Mr. Tarpley. Looking at the rights record of the participants of the meeting in Geneva, particularly that of the United States, it's somehow hard to believe that their only concern is human rights. I mean, can you tell us how a regime change in Syria may benefit every participant in that conference?
Well, the current U.S. policy under the Obama administration with Hillary Clinton at the State Department aims at the destruction of all sovereign states on this planet. It's really rolling the world situation back to the time before the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, which established the regime of modern independent sovereign states. The desperation of the U.S. and the British comes from their financial bankruptcy. And what they've got to do is increase the rate of exploitation and looting and sacking of the entire world economy. And in the course of this, they find that any national government is an intolerable obstacle. It gets in their way. It can say no, right? Mubarak said no to them on numerous occasions. Gaddafi said no most of the time. So they've decided to smash up these countries. But notice, their goal is not just regime change. It's now microstates, mini-states, to use the terms of Zbigniew Brzezinski, partition, the favorite term of George Soros, balkanization, failed states, rump states, warlords, warlords of the type that we see, for example, in Libya. So this is the goal, to have a situation where the International Monetary Fund and NATO rule the world from above, but then on the ground you've got a kind of crazy quilt of petty, squabbling, impotent little entities that could never resist ExxonMobil or J.P. Morgan Chase or Halliburton or anything of the kind. Something, again, like Libya today. So that's where they're headed with this. It would be then to break up Syria, to detach the Kurdish part, to detach parts that would be claimed by Turkey, to perhaps start the Lebanese civil war again. Perhaps there would be a continuous civil war in Syria. Perhaps Israel would start helping itself to various tracts of territory and so on down the line. So that's where it's going. It's very sinister.
Anyway, well, taking a look at the situation on the ground, I mean, for how long do you think Assad and the Assad administration in general will be able to absorb such huge pressure and stay in power?
I think indefinitely. I think for a very long time. And Assad's holding power may turn out to be greater than the holding power of the coalition that is arrayed against him. Now, this, of course, depends on Russia and China maintaining their current blocking position in the Security Council. Hillary Clinton, after that tirade, that outburst that we just heard, her hysterical plan is to go back to the UN Security Council and to try once again to get a Chapter 7 resolution through the Security Council, and that will include draconian economic sanctions, and it will eventually lead then to an armed attack, a no-fly zone, meaning bombing, humanitarian corridors, buffer zones, and so forth. That will be a massive attack on Syria. There's no indication that Russia will go along. Lavrov, leaving the proceedings today, said the important thing is that nothing has been imposed. And when we look at this empty formula that they've come up with, it's a kind of a face-saving piece of rhetoric or boilerplate for all of them. On the one side, Assad and his government have said, we will not accept a solution dictated by foreigners. That's sound policy. And then we have the Syrian National Council, always helpful in this way. They say they will never negotiate with Assad because Assad has blood on his hands. We're finding out right now, thanks to the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung of Germany, big conservative paper in Frankfurt, that it was the Syrian, the Free Syrian Army that carried out the Hula massacre. Not Assad, not the Syrian army, but rather these bloody NATO death squads that have been brought in, which Hillary Clinton is supporting, and Haig and Fabius and the rest of these people. And indeed, Kofi Annan, the hypocrite, is nothing but a front man for essentially these death squads.
Indeed. I mean, there is talk of a coalition government, and you've pointed to it briefly. I mean, how likely will this coalition government be formed, and just how much will Assad agree to it?
Well, there have been elections. That's another one of these sort of Orwellian features of these proceedings, right? There have just been elections in Syria in which more than 50%, I'm not sure exactly how many, but by all indications, more than half of the people who were registered to vote have voted, And there were opposition figures. Not everybody elected in those elections was from the Ba'ath Party. Of course, the Syrian National Council, a group of adventurers who like to live in expensive hotels and make pronunciations to the four points of the compass, they always say they won't negotiate. Why would they? They're living high on the hog the way it is. But there have been elections where you didn't have to be a member of the Ba'ath Party, so free elections have been held. But Kofi Annan said, those are not good enough, that's not what we mean. Well, what do you mean then, given the fact that the Syrian Free Army, the Syrian National Council, they say they won't participate in elections. So they are the ones who are intractable, and the guilt for the crisis goes to them. I think Assad can hold out for quite a while.
Indeed, fair enough. We'll leave it there for the time being. Many thanks to Dr. Webster Griffin Tarpley, author and historian from
Thank
Washington.
You.
I thought that was pretty important because to hear, because, you know, it's just there's another one that here that says Russia will confront any U.S.-led attack on Syria.
Right now.
That's what they stated, right? And it's by Tarpley as well stated, but he's repeating that from the Russians. And so, you know, essentially, it'll be really interesting to see if the United States isn't more than just a windbag, you know. But the problem is, and a major problem is that we still have, I mean, even if you were like, what's his face? Okay, Romney. You still got the same thing. You got worse. You got a guy tied that's so tied to the Jewish to the Israelis that his business partner was a Mossad agent. So,
that's a bit scary.
Yeah, I mean that's too scary for me. And but the problem is you got nothing. You got nothing on either side doing anything. And no hope.
And that's how it's been projected to be.
That's
the plan. That's the formula.
That's exactly right, yeah.
No
so,
surprise?
No, not at all. The next one I wanted to mention, I'd like to do this one, then we'll go to a quick music break.
Okay.
And then we'll, this one troubled me greatly when I read it, and I think it's
scary for everyone.
Yeah, this is from naturalnews.com, and we like to read a lot of their articles. Well done. And this is
it's a good site, folks. You should go to this site.
Naturalnews.com. Cell phone radiation. What the telecommunication companies don't want you to know, right? Natural News. In 2010, Devra Davis, PhD, MPH, president of the Environmental Health Trust, and former White House advisor, wrote the book entitled Disconnect, The Truth About Cell Phone Radiation, What the Industry Has Done to Hide It, and How to Protect Your Family. Dr. Davis shares her concerns. If the industry doesn't make a positive move soon, we may have a global epidemic on our hands within the next two decades. This global epidemic is not a scare tactic. There is study after study, over 500, on the ill effects of exposure to cell phone radiation.
Dr. Davis just wants the industry to be responsible. We are asking the industry to give people the facts about known health risks from cell phone radiation exposure to children's veins and ensure people know how to best use these devices. In 2011, the International Agency for Research on Cancer released a statement that cell phone radiation is a possible human carcinogen. Other possible human carcinogens include the exhaust from diesel engines and the banned pesticide DDT. Has this made a difference? Well, yes and no. Many other countries, including Canada, France, and Turkey, and Israel, have come out with safety guidelines, age-appropriate advertising, and introduced an institute to conduct research on the subject, respectively. In this country, a federal office has put out public knowledge three times in the past almost 20 years in regards to the necessity of studying the health implications created by cell phones. Unfortunately, the funds for such research are neither there nor have the potential to be there anytime soon.
The CTIA and the Right to Know. Numerous local governments spread out across the country are sitting on drafts of cell phone right to know ordinances, which would eventually become a law if passed. Cell phone right to know laws are simple and succinct. It's the consumer's right to know about any risk associated with using a cell phone and how to use the phone safely before the phone is actually purchased. So what is going on? Here's some insight. In the summer of 2010, San Francisco Board of Supervisors passed an ordinance giving residents of the community who purchased and used cell phones the right to know about the health risks and safety user guidelines associated with using the phone. The ordinance was signed into law by then-Mayor Gavin Newsom. This is the first of its kind. The CTIA then sued San Francisco, both the city and county, under the premise of violating cell phone companies' First Amendment rights. Some amendments were made to the law. However, the CTIA was not satisfied and has taken the decision to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. CTIA is waiting to see if this decision will stand or be appealed. And according to their website, CTIA is the International Association for the Wireless Telecommunication Industry, dedicated to expanding the wireless frontier. The association advocates on behalf of its members at all levels of government. CTIA has represented its members, the wireless communications industry, since 1984.
The industry seems to be hiding behind two things. One, they can't contend they have never said cell phones were safe. Two, the manual which accompanies the cell phone states in tiny wording that a cell phone should never be held next to the body in order to avoid exceeding the exposure limits set by the FCC. So how do you use it if you can't?
This
is akin to lying by omission, supplying the public with information the industry knows the consumer will never get. Clearly, telecommunication companies don't want cell phone users to be fully informed or question the safety of cell phones.
And I wanted to just say, I thought that this guy should be mentioned. The author of this is called Lloyd Burrow, and has spent the last 10 years researching the effects of electromagnetic fields on health after becoming electrically sensitive in 2002. He now offers practical advice on healthy living in our electromagnetic world. You can download his free EMF health report, subscribe to his newsletter by visiting his website, electricsense.com. I think I'm going to go to that. Electricsense.com. You can also follow him on Facebook.
Let's see what it says.
And just see what, maybe he's got something really interesting. had another short
audio
that I wanted to play here, but I'm not sure if I can find it.
What was that one on?
Which one?
The short audio.
It was on the Mexican Revolution that's happening down there. About a minute long.
That we never hear anything about.
That we never hear a word about. But there's millions of people. Lots and lots of folks down there right now. Really ticked off. Yeah. Oh, no. This one's good, too. This one is about 150,000 enraged Japanese demonstrate in Tokyo, right? I don't know if you just hear a lot of people, but the thing is that they're saying like nothing's happening there. You're just hearing nothing about these protests. You're hearing nothing about these poor people, and so let's
just
hear.
Well, if they wait it out, they'll die of
radiation poisoning. Yeah, and let's just hear the noise here. It's absolutely incredible. Let's try to see if I can lose my swell here. I thought there was for some reason there was audio earlier.
The audio's gone, I don't know why.
Sorry, folks. That's not a good thing. I have a lot of other stuff down, but it was very long. And nothing really to be short here. Let's see. This is the Monsanto, but there's a better one here that I wanted to talk about Monsanto before we go. Monsanto Rider, biotech companies are about to gain immunity from federal laws. Ready for that? It just makes me disgusted sick to learn this.
And the poor farmers, the GMO seeds are going, and then they invade their land, and then they're sued by Monsanto.
That's right.
For patent infringement.
That's right.
That, ridiculous.
And it's not just that. Immunity from federal law. So, if people get sick on these things,
they're not going to be charged with anything.
And they know. No
recourse.
They're not allowed to label the damn things, okay? I mean, it's just weird. It's ridiculous. But anyway, it says the Secretary of Agriculture would be required to grant a permit for the planting or cultivation of genetically engineered crop, regardless of the environmental impact. All right. So, while many Americans are firing up barbecues and breaking out the sparklers, this was written on July 6th, to celebrate Independence Day, biotech industry executives are more likely chewing champagne to celebrate another kind of independence immunity for federal law.
Boy.
Yeah. So-called Monsanto rider quietly slipped into the multi-billion-dollar FY 2013 agricultural appropriations bill would require, not just allow, but require the Secretary of Agriculture to grant a temporary permit for the planting or cultivating of a genetically engineered crop, even if the federal court has ordered the planting be halted until an environmental impact statement is complete. All the farmers or the biotech producer has to do is ask, and the questionable crop could be released into the government, into the environment, where they could potentially contaminate conventional or organic crops, and ultimately the nation's food supply. And unless the youth, the Senate, or a citizen's army of farmers and consumers can stop them, the House of Representatives is likely to ram this dangerous rider through any day now. And in a statement issued last month, the Center for Food Safety had this to say about the biotech industry's latest attempt to circumvent legal and regulatory safeguards. Ceding broad and unprecedented powers to the industry, the rider poses a direct threat to the authority of U.S. courts, jettisons the U.S. Department of Agriculture's established oversight powers on key agricultural issues, and puts the nation's farmers and food supply at risk. Now, why would this Congress want to do this? Unless, of course, they're totally paid off.
Well,
okay.
The House of Representatives, whoever put up that bill, and whoever is supporting it, they're all paid off
all
by that lobby.
That's right. In
That's
other words,
disgusting.
If this single line in the 90-page agricultural appropriations bill slips through, it's Independence Day for the biotech industry. Representative Peter DeFazio, Democrat of Oregon, sponsored an amendment to kill the writer. Good for Peter, all right, whose official name is the Farmer's Assurance Provision. But even if DeFazio's amendment makes it through the House vote, it still has to survive the Senate. Meanwhile, organizations like the Organic Consumer Association Center for the Food Safety, Food Democracy Now!, the Alliance for National Health USA, and many others are gathering hundreds of thousands of signatures to protest, in protest of the rider and in support of DeFazio's amendment. Will Congress do the right thing and keep what are arguably already weak safeguards in place to protect farmers and environment, or will industry win yet another fight in the battle to exert total control over our farm and food supply?
One can only guess.
Well, biotech's legislator of the year behind the latest sneak attack. Whom do we have to thank for the sneak attack on USDA safeguards? The Agricultural Subcommittee Chair, Jack Kingston, a Republican from Georgia, who not coincidentally was voted legislator of the year for 2011 to 2012 by none other than the Biotechnology Industry Organization, whose members include Monsanto and DuPont.
Oh, boy.
As reported by Mother Jones, the Biotechnology Industry Organization declared Kingston a champion of America's biotechnology industry, who has helped project funding for programs essential to survival of biotechnology companies across the United States. Now, this guy should be, shot and quartered, you know what I mean? Why he's running, why he's allowed, is because these damn companies were probably giving him trillions of dollars in his campaign to keep him there. Kingston clearly isn't interested in the survival of American farmers. Aiding and abetting Kingston is John C. Greenwood, former U.S. Congressman from Pennsylvania and now president of the Biotech Industry Organization. No stranger to the inner workings of Congress, Greenwood lobbied for the Farmers Assurance Provision in a June 13th letter to Congress, according to Mother Jones and Bloomberg, claiming that a stream of lawsuits has slowed approval and created uncertainties for companies developing GE crops. Greenwood was no doubt referring to several past lawsuits, including one brought in 2007 by the Center for Food Safety challenging the legality of the USDA's approval of Monsanto's Roundup Ready alfalfa. In that case, a federal court ruled that the USDA approval of GMO alfalfa violated environmental laws by failing to analyze risks such as the contamination of conventional and organic alfalfa, the evolution of geophosphate, glyphosate, resistant weeds, and increased use of Roundup. The USDA was forced to undertake a four-year study of GMO alfalfa impacts under the National Environmental Policy. During the four-year study, farmers were banned from planting the soil and selling the crop and creating the uncertainty that Greenwood is so worried about. Yeah, see, so, these sons of bitches, they just got the whole thing tied up, and it's not...
Very difficult for the farmers, though.
Yeah.
Just a nightmare.
Yeah, and it turned out that they, the uncertainty there is unbelievable itself. Who loses if Monsanto wins? Among the biggest losers if Congress ignores the DeFazio Amendment and passes the Farmers Assurance Provision are thousands of farmers of conventional and organic crops, including those who rely on the export market for their livelihoods. An increasing number of global markets are requiring GMO-free agricultural products or, at the very least, enforcing strict GMO labeling laws. If this provision passes, it will allow unrestricted planting of potentially dangerous crops, exposing other safe and non-GMO crops to risk of contamination.
Really.
As we were seeing in the past, farmers who grow crops that have been adequately tested and later found dangerous, or whose safe crops become contaminated by nearby unsafe crops, risk huge losses and potentially lawsuits from their customers. Ultimately, the entire U.S. agricultural market and U.S. economy suffers. And
to say nothing about
yeah.
what it does to us.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
horrible.
And this article is quite long and goes on, but it's just bad. The provision is bad. It's called National Environmental Policy Act and the Plant Protection Act of 2000. That's why we have laws like these, which was specifically designed to strengthen the safety net of agriculture producers. So check out the DeFazio's amendment, and it means a lot. Yeah, it's hard to believe that. I find what's so hard to believe is you have these companies that want nothing to do but destroy people. Destroy our lives, destroy
soulless
our
entities.
They're just soulless entities for nothing but profit. But you know, it kills people and
mm-hmm.
it destroys other farmers, it destroys organic farmers, it's going to destroy our exports. I mean, it's going to get to a point where no country will want to export anything from American, import anything. Okay, it's barely getting that way now. All right, so and I don't know, I'm very, very disgusted by this. We bring this up often about Monsanto and GMO, but you know, it's really just downright disgusting. I don't know. This is a little longer than I wanted. It's about 8 minutes, but it's a look at Monsanto's history.
Yeah, we can play a little bit of that. I think that'd be interesting.
Yeah, right after this one is. But there's also one on we're sending so much money overseas and getting and our entire infrastructure going to hell. Would you rather hear that one?
Well, I think everybody knows that.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't you want to go to that one?
Yeah.
This is on Russian TV, and Monsanto's history is marred by scandal.
It's just good to hear more about
that.
Yeah,
especially after what they're doing to, you know, what they're doing with this.
And Abby joined us earlier today to talk more Monsanto and GMO foods. I first asked her about Monsanto's history of scandals. Here's her take.
Yeah, Liz, there's so much scandal, it's hard to put all in one package, but going back to aspartame, it's an artificial sweetener that's 200 times sweeter than sugar, first owned by Cyril, who the CEO was Donald Rumsfeld at the time, and then when he joined Reagan's cabinet, they passed through aspartame when the National Association of Soft Drink Association said, we do not want this passed. All the tests that Cyril has presented to us are full of holes, shoddy at best. So that was passed through. Monsanto later acquired Cyril, and then you see the FDA commissioner who was appointed during that time that passed aspartame later joined the public relations firm for Monsanto and Cyril. So there's just a revolving door that goes back decades with these companies. Also, DDT, it was a pesticide that was produced by Monsanto that was banned in 1972. And since that ban, we've seen a tenfold increase in bald eagles and osprey. And also, bovine growth hormone, another interesting thing that Monsanto has tried to put a lockdown on the labeling of bovine growth hormone. We saw two reporters from Fox News who tried to put the story out, and Monsanto directly put the black hand of censorship over them and said, you know, you can't air this. And when they decided to go out with the story, they were subsequently fired. So there is a long slew of scandal that didn't even fit into this story today. That's just a small portion of, you know, what Monsanto has
done.
And
you had mentioned there a lot of the chemicals, a lot of the additives in these foods. Ultimately, how is that affecting our health here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, you don't see a lot of independent studies done in the U.S. because of a lack of funding. And Monsanto has threatened a lot of independent scientists with cutting their funding. So you see a lot of studies done outside of the U.S. Jeffrey Smith has some excellent research about this, but it's shown in animal studies cancer, birth defects, hormone inequalities, just a slew of things that are just found with genetically modified foods. Unfortunately, it's hard to test because we're all like sitting guinea pigs in our generation, since we don't know what's caused by what. So we're all eating genetically modified foods. It's in over 70% of all the foods in our supermarkets. A lot of people say, well, you know, I'm not eating GMOs, because they don't know. But the base of all foods in supermarkets is corn and soy, the majority of them, and all processed foods. So it is hard to tell, you know, where these health effects are coming from, diabetes and all these.
And that's the thing, because in other countries, they require labeling. Several other countries require labeling of GMO foods. And here in the U.S., Americans would like to know if the foods we are eating are GMO, contain GMO products. Why don't we have that labeling?
Well, unlike other countries, we have deemed GMO foods to be substantially equivalent. Bush Sr. Passed this through in 1992 with the FDA, and what it says is that GMO foods are substantially equivalent to non-GMO foods, so they're pretty much equal, and that's completely different than any other country, really, in the European world.
One's GMO, the other's not.
Right. Well, they're both, apparently, according to the FDA, there's no proof, and unlike other countries, the U.S. does not require their own independent tests to verify whether these foods are safe or not. What they do is have these firms and agricultural giants conduct their own research and tests. And when the FDA passed this as substantially equivalent, there was internal documents released later from FDA scientists that said, hey, this isn't true, and we completely disagree with this, but it's kind of been swept under the rug. Like I said, there's a revolving door between this corporation and the government, all the way back to the acquisition of Cyril and also Michael Taylor, who was working for Monsanto as the vice president, is now the food safety czar in Obama's cabinet.
And it seems like there's a lot of between businesses and congressmen and this revolving door. Ultimately, if it's not benefiting and not in the best interest of Americans, how is this all able to happen?
Through lobbying. I mean, really, this corporation has so much control over the research and over the facts in this country. And we just saw Vermont try to take initiatives to form their own labeling law, and it didn't pass through because they were scared of a lawsuit from Monsanto. I mean, Monsanto's gone after 144 small farmers because their crops have cross-pollinated, and just their whole business practice with their seeds. They have patents on their genetically modified seeds, and if these genetically modified seeds cross-pollinate, which crops do out in open fields. I mean, these aren't contained in domes, so of course, you know, pollen's going to spread in other fields, and when it does, they can go over to these farmers' land and say, you need to destroy not only this harvest, but all of your past harvests of seeds. And for small farmers, I mean, this is their whole family, this is their whole livelihood, are these seeds that have been, you know, part of their generations. So their seed renewal tactics are
We have 10 seconds left, but I just want to say I'm going to continue this for the next 3 minutes, and you can pick it up in the archives, and please join us tomorrow as well.
Good night. Completely horrendous, according to these farmers, the lawsuits, the threats. I mean, and there's this huge corporation. How could people possibly stand up to them? And when the government really isn't doing anything, and when you see the revolving door, it's just really hard to face up to this, you know, Goliath.
And are farmers fighting back?
Yes, they are. Last year we saw 250,000 small farmers, which is a lot, try to do a counter lawsuit against Monsanto. Unfortunately, a district judge dropped the case. But in Brazil, 5 million Brazilian farmers are suing Monsanto, which is a huge number. And Monsanto has so many monocrops of soy and corn across the world, and we see a lot of countries either banning Monsanto outright or requiring labeling because they are more taking the preventative action instead of saying, you know, we're going to wait and see after these generations, like America's doing, where they're saying, you know, there's no proof. They're kind of taking preemptive measures and saying there is enough proof and we're going to, you know, give the consumers the choice. And I really think that's the real issue here, is that it's not even about the health effects. It's about giving consumers the choice to eat GMO foods or not. And that's the choice that we don't have right now.
And so, and you had mentioned a huge percentage of the food that you go to the grocery store that is on our shelves do contain GMOs. I mean, as a consumer, what can one do to kind of take control of what they're putting into their bodies?
It's really hard, Liz, because even some stores like Whole Foods, who tout, you know, as mainly organic, even they have not said that they're completely organic. It's very hard to tell now what is organic and what really isn't. But mostly, you know, just supporting local farmers, going to your farmer's market, buying organic as much as you can. There's a non-GMO shopping guide and an app that I actually just downloaded on my iPhone where you can determine, you know, where to shop, who to support, what's really going on, because it really is up to us. It's up to us, the consumer, because we really can't count on these regulatory bodies to determine whether or not these foods are safe when we see this kind of corruption and collusion going on.
All right. Well, luckily there was a natural farmers market over here in D.C. over the weekend. I'm glad I was able to check that out. Hopefully we'll see more of those. Abby, thanks for staying on top of this really important story. That was Abby Martin, RT correspondent.
All right. So, yeah, I'll tell you. That's
about it. We're right to the end of our show. And I guess that's no big surprise to anyone, but... But it's just a reminder that we have to be vigilant with companies like Monsanto. We really have to try to change what they're trying to do, not have them be successful.
And you might also want to check out on YouTube a video called Farmageddon. Farmageddon, truth about the food and dairy industry. And that might shake you to the roots, I think. Another one is mainstream media dying. I love that one. Okay, so everybody, I hope you enjoy this. I am just going to zap this up to my Facebook. I'm going to share this. All my buddies on Facebook, they can see this much, because they, most of them really hate Monsanto as well, and I think this will like.
Got it?
No, I didn't. Still, look, what else? Let's move on. Okay, just hit that.